Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm still Bruce Berner, and I still teach law school at Valparaiso University. I hope, I haven't been there now in so long, I hope I still have my job. During these 2 weeks, I was talking last week about the criminal justice system, and this week about the civil justice system, principally those kinds of cases which lawyers call torts, which most people simply call accident cases, cases involving people who are injured, usually as a result of the unintentional behavior of other people. I want to talk today about a very particular case that I was involved in the late 70s and early 80s. Some of you may remember it. It was the criminal trial of the Ford Motor Company in Indiana, arising out of the design of the Ford Pinto automobile. Before I give you the facts of the case, let me just spend about 2 minutes and talk about the legal structure that the case has to be fit into. If we talk about crime, and this case is really the intersection of crime and tort, and you'll notice it's a criminal case, but most cases involving defective products are not criminal cases. They're tort cases in which the people hurt are looking for money damages. If we start on the crime side and think in terms of homicide, cases in which the allegation is that someone has caused someone else's death, we see there's actually a lot more distinctions than this, but the most important one is those cases which involve a bad intention. And almost always in homicide, we mean there an intent to kill, people who kill on purpose. Historically, we call that murder, and we consider that short of treason in the old days, the most serious crime that a person can commit, at least in the civil legal system. But there's another kind of homicide, which is less than murder, and it's not based on a bad intention, and this is called manslaughter. Actually, you can divide manslaughter into voluntary manslaughter and involuntary manslaughter. What we're going to talk about today is unintentional manslaughter. So it's a killing which is not on purpose, but in which the state of mind of the defendant is alleged to be reckless. We talk about recklessness. Some states talk about willful and wanton misconduct. In other words, it's sort of people who don't want you to die, but they don't take much care that you don't either. Okay. So I think it's interesting, by the way, if you look at the word manslaughter, it's the exact same letters and in the exact same order as the words man's laughter. I have no idea what to make of that. I just throw it out because there it is. And I was an English major, so I look at stuff like that and probably has no meaning. On the tort side, let's start at the bottom. The usual tort case, the usual accident case, is a case in which the plaintiff alleges that the defendant was negligent. And negligent is a fancy French-rooted word for what we would simply call careless. Okay. Didn't pay enough attention to what you're doing, looked away from the road, whatever, you were careless. If you cause injury or death to someone, then you can be liable in tort to pay for their damages. In our situation, in terms of products that are unsafe, negligence usually gets translated into products that are unreasonably dangerous. So if a manufacturer makes a product that is unreasonably dangerous, the manufacturer, if someone gets hurt by that product, Mr. Coffee, for example, is one of the great favorites because for a long time there they blew up at certain points unexpectedly, and so there were a lot of Mr. Coffee suits. And those cases were very routine, and Mr. Coffee would settle. Mr. Coffee would send Mr. Lawyer, and Mr. Lawyer would actually settle the case. But there's another, and what you get in those cases is what's called compensatory damages. That is, what you're looking for is an amount of money to make you whole, the way the law puts it. So you're paid for doctor bills, lost wages, and then for pain and suffering. In death cases, of course, then we have to make a rather crude kind of decision about how much money to give to the heirs to represent the life of the person. That gets involved It's awkward, to be sure, to try to translate certain things into pain and suffering into dollars. How do you do that? Someone's life into dollars raises even more dramatic questions. But you don't want to let the best be the enemy of the good, and so you do the best you can. You can't bring the person back to life at this point. The legal system's good, but it's not that good. And so the best we can do is to award some money. In some cases, though, in tort situations, you can get what are called punitive damages. Here, however, it's not enough to show that the defendant was careless or negligent. Now the obligation is on the plaintiff to show that the defendant was reckless and engaged in willful and wanton misconduct, had guilty knowledge and didn't pay any attention to it, ran a great risk knowing what that risk was. Well, you'll notice that that's quite the same as manslaughter. You'll notice that there's a great overlap here, and so we're going to find cases which will fit both categories. The great legal theoretician Prosser one time was asked, what's the difference between negligence and recklessness? And he said, I'll answer that with a question. What's the difference between a fool and a damn fool? It's the same thing. It's a difference in degree. A person who is reckless is just more careless or creates more risk. On August 10th of 1978, three teenage girls, Judy Lynn and Donna Ulrich, 17 and 16, two sisters and a cousin, were driving near Goshen, Indiana on U.S. Highway 33 in a Ford Pinto sedan, a 1973 Ford Pinto sedan. Which the mother and father of the sisters had recently purchased for them. They were on their way to a church volleyball game. It's about 6 o'clock at night, sunny, beautiful late summer evening in Indiana. Not as beautiful as out here, but for us it was a beautiful evening. For reasons which we will never know, about a mile after gassing up the car, filling it with gas, they began to either slow the car down dramatically and unexpectedly, or they actually brought the car to a complete stop on the roadway. And there's conflicting evidence about whether the car was stopped or whether it was merely decelerating when it was hit. At any rate, the driver following them, young man in a Chevrolet van, had plenty of room between himself and the Pinto, but then dropped a cigarette. He reached down to pick up the cigarette, fished around for it, picked it up, and when he looked up, he was just all over the top of the Pinto. That is, that it had done something which he would not have expected it did, and just almost the moment that he saw the car, he hit the car. And the moment he hit the car, he saw nothing but flames. There were about six eyewitnesses who saw the impact. We were either driving behind the van or were coming up the other way. And all of them described that there was, so far as they could tell, no lapsing of time between the time the car was struck and the time the car was not just sort of burning, but was nothing but flames. And we've actually seen some pictures of crash tests that the government did in this kind of collision. And what happens is when the gas gets crushed out, it comes out hydrostatically, it almost comes out as a vapor. And they took high-speed photography, 1,000 frames a second. And in one frame, you see nothing. In the next frame, you see nothing but flames all over. That's how fast this is because the gas vaporized. The car spun out. Two of the girls were incinerated between 2 and 4 seconds is the best estimate of the pathologists, and I'll tell you a little more about them later. The driver actually lived 7 hours. The driver and you never know whether to say fortunately or unfortunately because it was an incredibly difficult 7 hours. The reason she was not incinerated so fast is she was partially thrown from the car. So part of her body was out of the car as it's spinning down the road. The police officer who investigated it had, at that point, 10 years of experience in investigating. He was a state trooper investigating highway accidents. He said in the 1,000 cases or so that he had investigated, this struck him right from the beginning as the most unusual, in that the amount of the injuries bore no relation to the kind of injuries you would expect. That is, it had all the earmarks of a collision from which people should just walk away. I'll circulate some pictures here of the two vehicles, the van and the Pinto. And as you look at them, try to imagine that these two cars were in the same accident. Because the van shows very, very minimal damage. It had a stiff front, it has a radiator right behind it, it's a very heavy car. The Pinto is a very light car, and in addition to that, is built without a frame. It was a unit, so-called unibody construction. So it's a very soft car. It's probably true that it would have been a very, very safe car, as small as it was, from the usual kind of kinetic forces that you get in an accident, because the rear end is so soft, it'll collapse and it will absorb a lot of the energy. Imagine yourself getting hit in a tank. Well, when you get hit, the shock of that force comes all the way through, and people are jumping around in there because none of the energy gets taken up by the collapsing of the metal. The Pinto was a nice, soft, rear-ended car and was probably pretty safe if you didn't lose gas. That is, if the fuel system held up, it probably would have been a pretty good car to get hit from behind in it, if you ever want to get hit from behind. One of the things that was very interesting about the case is all of the different ways of trying to prove how high speed a collision it was. Prosecution, of course, is interested in showing that the accident happened at a fairly low closing speed. And a low closing speed means the difference. If two things are moving in this direction, the difference in the miles per hour of the one in the front and the one behind. Turns out that if something going 15 miles an hour hits a stationary object, that's precisely the same, engineering-wise, as hitting something going 35 at 50. Okay? So all that really matters is the difference in speeds. Of course, if they're coming at each other, then you have to add the speeds together. That's why head-ons are so bad. But when you get a tail end, the difference. Well, our eyewitnesses generally said that the closing speed was between 15 and 20 miles an hour, that they had the van going at 50 to 55 and the Pinto going at 35 when it was hit, decelerating, but still they estimated at about 35. Ford took the position that the speed was higher. We actually, they suggested it was 60 miles an hour. The interesting thing about it is we had, Ford had a lot of experts, we had some experts. There's a variety of ways to figure out, or to try to figure out, how fast cars are going when they hit. If you have skid marks and rollout, you can apply a series of engineering and mathematical formulas that tell you about what speed will produce that length of skid mark and rollout. So that was one way. Probably the best way is through what's called crush analysis. That is, someone who knows things like strength of metals, an automotive engineer, will simply look at the damage of the car and can assess from the damage what the rate of closing speed was. And there, our engineering expert had the closing speed at 35 miles an hour. So it's an interesting problem for the lawyers. We didn't put him on the stand because he contradicts our own eyewitnesses. Our eyewitnesses say 15 to 20. He says 35. Ford's expert had it at about 55. That was interesting to me that they applied the same formulas, and they're mathematicians. You think those are very hard sciences. You understand why psychiatrists always disagree about sanity, but how physicists disagree on how a formula works out was interesting to us. The other thing that you can use to get some window into the speed is how badly were the people hurt. When we did the pathology on the three bodies, it was interesting to find that there were three broken bones. Two to the passenger in the front seat, one to the passenger in a rear seat, none to the driver of the car. That troubled us. Broken bones usually are an indicator of speed until we brought the chief medical examiner of Chicago in, and he did the autopsy for us and found that the brakes were all thermal brakes. That is, that the bones had broken not from impact but from heat, the heat of the incineration. So once we learned that, that's pretty good evidence that's a fairly low, it's a collision you ought to walk away from if the fire doesn't get you. Could there have been a civil suit brought by the parents of the girls? Absolutely. And it was, as a matter of fact, 2 years previously in California, a young man named Russell Grimshaw was involved in a rear-end collision in a Pinto and was subject to tremendous injuries, was not killed, and had sued for it and had recovered a verdict of $126.2 million punitive. The judge in that case reduced it to six, but it was one of many cases that Ford was facing around the country on the fuel system of the Pinto. In fact, lawyers knew that it was a pretty easy case down here. There were all kind of witnesses who you could get who would tell you that the fuel system design in this particular car was unreasonably dangerous. We'll talk a little bit more about how they show that. But the interesting thing to us was that not only could you show that the fuel system was unreasonably dangerous by having independent engineers and experts look at it, if you looked at the Ford Motor Company internal documents, you would find that they knew it too. It was that jump from unreasonably dangerous product to some pretty powerful evidence in Ford's own records that they knew ahead of time how dangerous it was that suggested the move in many of these cases to punitive damages. In our case, the prosecutor, after the state policeman came back and mentioned this to the prosecutor, and they talked late in the evening, and they got madder and madder the more they talked about, because the police officer had read some articles about the Pinto and about the civil suits and about what was happening. After several weeks, they contacted the parents and said that they were thinking of bringing a criminal case here for what was in Indiana called reckless homicide, but which is the same as involuntary or unintentional murder. Interestingly enough, they were not going to bring the criminal case if the family wanted to bring a civil case seeking punitive damages, because as you've seen, both of those suits could be brought. But the prosecutor didn't want to get in the way of the family if they felt they were going to bring this action. The family were members of a religious sect which do not believe in lawsuits. And they never brought a civil lawsuit. But they said to the prosecutor that they thought he should bring a criminal case, that they were in favor of that. They thought what the little bit they knew what Ford had done was wrong, and they were very happy to have. So it was an interesting situation. In a lot of cases, you wouldn't bring the action because you want to stay out of the way of the civil suit. Here, they made it quite clear they weren't going to bring one, and so a criminal case began. The prosecutor's initial choice was, who do we charge? We can either charge the driver of the van, or we can charge the manufacturer. Historically, prosecutors have chosen the driver of the van. That is, whoever caused the immediate accident, whoever made that accident happen in their mind, that was a pretty logical defendant. What the prosecutor did in this case was to call a grand jury. You don't have to call a grand jury, it's not required, but the prosecutor said, I'm nervous enough about all of this, I want to see what the general public thinks about this. So he got a grand jury together, which is just regular folks, And they told them the story of what had happened, including what the van driver had done wrong. And they had one person, a witness who I'll tell you about in a moment, who had been a previous Ford Motor Company executive and who left. Now, at this point, was testifying against Ford in many cases. It's a very interesting story. He was fired for being too concerned about safety. In fact, he turned Chevrolet in for the Corvair. When they bought the Corvair, they test drove it. And you remember that oversteer problem that the Corvair had, where you go around a corner, where the back end would keep going because the engine was in the back? Well, he said, I'm going to call Washington on this because this is unsafe. They said, if you call Washington on this, we're going to fire you. He called Washington on that. But before he called Washington on that, over a weekend, he took five filing cabinets out of the Ford Motor Company and took them home, and thereby assured his status as an expert witness for the rest of his life, because there was a lot in those files in terms of that. The grand jury indicted the Ford Motor Company for reckless homicide. The four women of the grand jury said, we don't see, to us it's a question of balancing 5 seconds of inattention, the van driver, and 8 years of knowledge of what was going to happen for Ford Motor Company. So that was how the grand jury sort of saw it. Okay, the game was on. The prosecutor then said, we have now undertaken to file an indictment against the Ford Motor Company. Our guess is they will fight. They will fight hard, and they're going to bring a lot at us, and they did. The prosecutor has a staff of 7 lawyers, all part-time. And a yearly budget, which was stretched to the maximum already now in August. One of the first things he sat down with his chief deputy, and they said, "We need help, and what we need to find are people who are at the same time knowledgeable and stupid, knowledgeable enough to help us with all the legal research that we're going to need to do in this case. And Ford's going to throw every legal theory in the book at us." And stupid enough to do this for free. Now, where do you find people who have that kind of knowledge and that kind of stupidity? Law professors, right? Who have nothing better to do, who will be intrigued by the fact that this is a kind of a frontier case. And so he got two of us, myself and Terry Kiley from the DePaul Law School in Chicago. And my background was the criminal side. Terry's background was the products liability side. And this really was, in fact, both cases. It was really a punitive damage tort, product liability cases for unreasonable design, wedded to the idea of using the criminal law for punishment. See, it was always my theory, as a criminal lawyer, that punitive damages from torts was poaching on our territory. That this is the system, the tort system is what you do when you want to compensate people. The criminal system is the one that's really set up historically to punish people. And what we're talking about here is not compensating the girls. Because the statute that we were dealing with doesn't provide for monetary recovery that goes to the victims or the victim's family. It amounted to a fine. Interestingly enough, Ford was exposed to 3 fines of $10,000 each. That was the statutory penalty for reckless homicide. There was jail time involved, too, if you were a regular, ordinary human being, but we didn't name any human beings as defendants. We named this artificial entity called the Ford Motor Company. Since you can't put the Ford Motor Company in jail, since it doesn't have any corporeal existence, it's just a legal fiction, all you can do is fine them, and that's $10,000 account, or $30,000. Ford's own estimates after the case is that they spent $4.5 million defending the case. So you can see that the fine is not really what was involved. And now I need to talk about kind of another problem. A kind of an ethical problem that we had. Local prosecutors have a tremendous amount of discretion in who they prosecute. And so when you prosecute a corporation, you can do it a great amount of damage. And we were concerned about that the whole time. In fact, as I'll tell you later, there's a sense in which I'm glad we didn't win the case, at least win the case in the sense of get a verdict. We won the case in so many other ways that the fact that Ford is finally acquitted seems to me to be in some... you wouldn't have caught us saying that at the time. Okay. But now, as you look back on it, it might be good that we didn't win the case in terms of getting a verdict, because what Ford said is, how are we worse than General Motors? They have this thing called the Vega, which was the same vintage as the Pinto. Both came out in 71. It's the same kind of car. It has the same general problem with the fuel system. It did. It wasn't as bad as the Pinto. And, you know, our prosecutor's response is, a Vega didn't blow up in our city. We can only, you know, bloom where you're planted. Whatever. We got to bring the cases that we can. We can't go all over the country looking for these cases, right? And what about this American Motors thing called the Gremlin? You remember that? Which was almost as bad as the Pinto and ugly. Okay? And ugly.
Aesthetics count.
Yeah, aesthetics count. So Ford would say, why are we worse than the others? But our theory really was that the Ford Motor Company was for us a surrogate for all of these companies. That yes, maybe they were all doing it, and so we have to single you out because it's your car, and the nature of the law is we can't sue everybody because it didn't happen, but there is a sense in which you're a surrogate for it. All right, what are some of the, then I'll open it up, what are some of the things that we found? Well, let's look at the legal issues first. Ford filed a motion to dismiss, and this is where the law professors and our students got involved. We each came equipped with an army of law. We each had, at any point, 6 to 8 law students working for us from Valparaiso or DePaul. One of the proudest things I have brought from this case is I don't think there's any question that 8 law students out-researched the entire legal department of the Ford Motor Company on this case, who probably had at any given point 60 to 70 lawyers working on the case. So these students, they were devoted, they were fervent. They learned how to break into the law libraries at the 2 law schools at night to keep this research alive. legal issues. Can a corporation commit homicide? The whole theoretical problem. That is, of course we understand what happens when a criminal case is brought against a person, because now we're going to focus community condemnation on that person, and we're going to put that person in jail if it's a terrible crime. But, you know, and the press had a field day with this. Showed a picture of the car in a cell. Right? You know, what are you going to do? Put them in? Who are you going to put in jail? Nobody. Why are you doing this? It's silly. We'd say, go over to Ford and ask them if they think it's silly. They're spending $4.5 million. They don't think it's silly. They think it's wrong, and they don't like us very much, but they don't think it's silly. And that's interesting. One of the Ford personnel said a very interesting thing to us. He said, $126 million verdict doesn't scare us. We know how to plan for almost anything if we can predict exactly what it is. We don't know what the fallout is from this case. We don't know what the image loss is to a criminal conviction for someone to go on the news and say Ford Motor Company committed homicide. He said, we don't have any idea what that means. And that's one of the a real difference between the civil system and the criminal system is something very much more profound is being said with a criminal conviction. And they weren't sure. They weren't sure what it was. A lawyer in Windsor, Canada, who represented a lot of the Ford executives, told us later, every time Ford would get sued in a civil case, $100 million, $200 million, this and that, his phone didn't ring. The minute our case hit the paper, he said, I was, you know, criminal. He said the switchboard lit up like a Christmas tree, and he would have to talk to them what this means. So there was a sense in which our case and cases like it had a way of kind of getting attention and focusing attention on it. We had some some odd little legal problems. The Indiana statutes were not in very good shape. In fact, the statute which made corporations liable for or exposed to homicide became effective only 41 days before the accident. That was real tough, because most of what we're trying to say was Ford's guilty knowledge happened way back in history. See, we tried the case in 80, but the car was in developmental stage from 68 to 70. So a lot of our documents were what was going on back then. We really got this problem with the Indiana statute that didn't make it crunch. So what do? We say, well, what they really did was they failed to warn people in the period from July 1st, 78 to August 10th, 78. So we had to kind of maneuver the legal theories to even make it possible. But that was, it was interesting to us that that was by far their strongest argument. They hardly made it. The argument they wanted to make was that the fact that motor vehicles were regulated at the federal level by a group called the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, that that preempted the field, and so individual states couldn't do anything more. That is, the feds are regulating this, states get out of the way. Does anybody see why they make that argument? Which is a tough argument for them to make legally, in which they finally end up losing on. Instead of the nice little ex post facto argument they can make in Indiana because their statute comes too late?
Well, the federal one, they covered under all states then.
Right. Absolutely. If they win on the ex post facto theory, they only win this case, right, and crashes in Indiana prior to this time. If they can win on preemption, they win all cases for all time, and the states have to stay out of their way. That's what sociologists of law call the phenomenon of the repeat player. If you get someone who's a party in lawsuits all the time, repetitively, like manufacturers, they always want to win on a theory that will cover all the rest of the cases, so they can win them all at once. To us, it was an interesting thing that Ford was doing, and all companies were doing it. They were claiming at the same time that states were preempted by the federal government. And then they had huge legal staffs at work lobbying the federal government not to regulate. In fact, those of you who want to look at it later, we knew that something had happened in 71. We didn't know what it was when we read through the documents. Right up until the beginning of 71, Ford and General Motors and Chrysler were apoplectic about the government coming in and a lot of new safety regulations. They were going to require that you withstand a 30-mile-an-hour rear-end hit and not leak gas. They were going to require passive restraints, seat belts, and airbags by 1976. And all of a sudden, magically, all the pressure stopped. And we saw nothing else in the documents after that. And we had almost daily memos by the time we got done collecting all this information. Stop. About 8 years after the trial, a lot of information became available under the Freedom of Information Act. And I have here a transcript of a meeting on April 27, 1971 in the Oval Office. And the participants are President Richard Nixon, John Ehrlichman, Henry Ford II, and Lee Iacocca. And it's during this conversation that Nixon says, I'm going to tell the regulators to back off. And I'll pass it around if you want to look. It's got some, let me get those pictures going around too. It's got some great quotes in here, including Lee Iacocca saying, the Japs are killing us, Mr. President, you're going to have to help.
Like Marx in
those sections. Well, I'll start the pictures this way. The pictures I'm showing you are of the Pinto itself. I'm sorry I did not bring the van. I thought I did, but... Okay. What do you want to talk about the case? Yeah?
Back to the, is the corporation guilty of murder? Where did you go with it? What were the arguments? A little more on the arguments.
Yeah.
Where did it end up? That seems to me a pretty critical point in terms of people versus the megalith there.
Yeah. There was a history already of corporations being found guilty of certain kinds of crimes. Most of the early cases involve ships companies that ran ships, companies that ran buses, and had very, very shoddy practices and would get them into an accident and kill a lot of people. You get that kind of what we call episodic recklessness. What made this case unusual and what got the press's attention is that it was the first attempt to prosecute as a homicide case negligence based on product liability. The common law said guilt is personal. Guilt is something that belongs to a person. The corporation can't have it because it's an artificial entity. The theory that's now developed, and all states buy into it now, is a corporation can commit a crime in the way that it can do anything. You know, we used to ask questions of students when you taught the corporate fiction. Can a corporation do this? Can a corporation ride a bicycle? Does the corporation ever have to go to the bathroom? Yeah. Well, those sound like ridiculous questions. Well, of course, a corporation, qua corporation, can't do anything. It only acts through its human agents. So the real question is, under what circumstances do you take the crimes of its own agents done on behalf of the corporation and impute them to the corporation? We always have done that on the civil side. If you get hit by a laundry truck and it's driven by Joe, you're not going to sue Joe. You're going to sue the owner of the laundry business because they're responsible for the actions of their employees. On the civil side, we knew that. On the criminal side, it took a lot longer for us to do that. But Ford, in their brief, said, what's next? Corporations being prosecuted for rape? And that's what we call exploiting the corporate fiction, trying to get the court to think that corporations can't do anything. But as a matter of fact, several corporations have been convicted of rape since then. If some of them were psychotherapists run by a corporation, and they were having sex with a lot of the patients as part of the therapy, and that was the corporate program. Been convicted of corporate rape. So, yeah, that was one of the toughest theoretical issues. I don't know. Do you want more on that, or is that?
Well, I just thought that corporations, you know, I don't know how long ago, had been striving to be felt as though they were individual, gave them additional rights,
right.
And therefore
right.
They'd already established the fact that they were an individual, and therefore
yes. They are a person, they are a legal person, and they are an entity and all this. One of the interesting things, the more we study this, and we had the help of some people who had done a lot of organizational behavior studies and studies of bureaucracies, one thing that's very interesting, it's possible for a corporation the size of the Ford Motor Company to make a decision that really doesn't belong to any of the individuals in that corporation. That is, it truly is a corporate decision. In this case, for example, Iacocca says, here's the deal, here's what we need. And of course, the Toyotas and the Datsuns and the Volkswagen were killing them. They wanted to get into the subcompact market. He got all the automotive engineers together and he said, here's the program. 2,000 pounds, $2,000, 42 inches high. That's what I want. And I want it in 24 months. Well, from conception to mass production, the fastest Detroit had ever done it was 48 months. I mean, development of a car for mass production, big, long project. You've got all kinds of sectors, and then you go through some mock-up cars, and then you go through safety testing. They took all of that and collapsed it to 23 months. That's part of why they got themselves in trouble. They had the tools and dies all set, the lines were set. That was happening at the same time as the safety test. And the safety testing gets done, and one of our witnesses was the guy who was on the safety line, the crash tester. He became a whistleblower and left, and now he testifies against Ford. And they looked at the test results one day, and he said, I looked at my friend, he looked at me, and they said, uh-oh. They didn't exactly say uh-oh, they said something else. But they knew at that point that the lines were too far along. Mm-hmm. And that's where the documents really get interesting. The documents were very damaging for Ford, their own internal documents. very damaging. For one thing, that wasn't an era when a lot of these when they thought a lot of these lawsuits were even going to happen. They didn't think anybody outside the company were ever going to get at these documents. In fact, it's a fabulous story how the lawyers get these documents. It happens in some of the strangest of ways, but a lot of it is through disaffected employers, former employees. Yeah.
Thank you. Question, is it possible that the corporate charter be pulled and they're out of business?
Yes.
For a corporate, that to happen to a corporation. Yeah.
Since that time, we've gotten a little more, a lot of states have gotten a little more innovative in terms of how do you create a penalty structure for this thing called a corporation. The classic penalty structure was put together with natural persons in mind. That's why jail is what we almost always see in crime.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is a corporate death penalty in some states. One of the problems is almost all corporations, big corporations, are licensed in Delaware. That's where the charter comes from. Okay. There's a lot of tax reasons for that. And also, they lobbied the Delaware legislature, which has very, very favorable laws for the way you make corporations. Okay. But yeah, one federal judge found a way to put a corporation in jail. And that is, he ordered a fence be put up around their factory and nobody be allowed in or out for the next 3 months. So he put the plant in jail for 3 months. So, but you know, federal judges have a little more leeway than state judges to kind of manufacture that kind of thing. Yeah.
If at all, how did Ralph Nader and Not Safe at Any Speed figure into this trial? My dates aren't good as to when he was doing that.
We talked to Nader three different times. He came out and saw us three different times. He was able to get us a lot of documents. His deep background was General Motors. That's the company that he had studied in Unsafe at Any Speed. But he was very, very supportive. We were having a hard time getting documents out of NHTSA, the federal agency. Now, here's the federal agency designed to regulate cars, and we're bringing this suit, and they're not giving us any. They were really, for a lot of reasons, they felt threatened too. So the one thing Nader was able to do is to talk to the head of NHTSA and persuade them to cooperate with us. So in that sense, Ralph Nader was an interesting guy. I ate lunch next to Ralph Nader, and I don't just drop that as a name, but because eating lunch next to Ralph Nader is an experience in itself.
Did you eat much of it?
First of all, we're at a prepared lunch, right? And everybody eats what's coming. Not Ralph. He's got his own stuff, and it's in foil. And then he'll look at what you're eating, and he'll say things like, "You know how much cadmium is in that? Do you know what happened to a lady in Iowa who ate some of those?" Oh boy! Huh? When we picked him up at the airport, he came and talked at our school. He sent us a list of vehicles that we could use. All others he would not accept a ride in. Yeah. So yeah, he was real helpful.
I have two comments that if my husband ate lunch next to you and you ate lunch next to Ralph Nader, can he claim some brush with fame?
Yeah. Two steps from Ralph. Ralph had another thing Ralph did. He was, in terms of his a physical person, big tall guy.
Yeah.
You know, General Motors put private eyes on him for 2 years, and they couldn't find anything on him. I mean, he's so clean, but what one thing he'll do is, if you tell him something he wants to remember, he'll write it on his shirt. He didn't care what he looked like. He kept notes all over his white shirt.
My question, I guess my question about Ralph Nader is, at what point, if someone like Ralph Nader is exposing the dangers of a car, such as the Pinto, at what point is the customer expected to take such things into consideration before buying it? I mean,
right.
So let's say Ford has kept this quiet and hasn't obviously not been forthcoming about the dangers, but someone else has leaked the dangers. So at what point does the buyer beware? Do you turn that into the case and
right.
say, why did these parents buy a car that had been exposed as unsafe for their children? Or does
well,
that not figure?
Yeah, it does figure, and there are a couple of answers. First of all, most people didn't know. that the dangers were additional at that time. It isn't until later when these cases begin to happen. And after all, the first couple of cases, you put down to zany lawyers anyway, right? Somebody got hurt, they're trying to put it off on somebody else. So it takes a while before you get enough of these cases to sort of get people's attention. The other thing that's very interesting is that, and they even say this in the document going around, at that time, safety didn't sell.
Right.
It was not something that they wanted to market because they didn't think the public cared much about it. They wanted their cars to go fast. They wanted them to be cheap. So when Iacocca says 2,000 pounds, $2,000, 42 inches, the engineers go, we can't do this. They do the safety testing. They go, we can't do it and make it safe. Who wants to tell Lee? And it turns out nobody wants to tell Lee. And so the car kind of gets made. That's what I meant before when I said it's really not anybody's decision. No one set out to say, let's build a dangerous car. But after the lines were up, they knew it was dangerous. In fact, there's a very famous document called the Grish-Zombie Memorandum in which, and I don't even know what position they held in the company anymore, we used to, in which they said, we project from this there will be 18,000 burn injuries over a particular period of time, 180 burn deaths. And then they said, so we'll take 180,000 times the average amount of the injury. And then we'll take 180, which is the burn deaths, times the value of life, which is, oh, let's use $200,000. So they use $200,000. They multiply all that together, and they have a number over here. That's the loss. They have the number over here. If we fix the car and get it to the point where it'll withstand this, here's what it'll cost. This number is bigger than that number. Let's not change the car.
Jesus.
Now, understand that when you're in business, at some level you have to do something like that. You have to work a cost-benefit analysis. But understand also that when average people hear how you're doing that, and especially the level at which you're evaluating their life, they are not amused.
That's my question. When did Lee Iacocca know? How far did those kind of memos go? And when in the case did you find with your research that they did know?
Yes.
Early on?
They knew, but probably because they moved this car along so fast. It's probably true that that car would have been built differently if they had known this about 6 months earlier. But they, but they're doing the, they're putting the line together and the design work and the tools and dies as their crash test goes. Let me give you one day of crash testing. We found two crash tests done on the same day in 1968. Crash test 1615 and crash test 1616. 1615 is an English Rover, which was a vehicle that was on the road. It was a subcompact car. It had the fuel system up above the rear axle. Our contention all along is that safe gas tanks are put in front of the rear axle, more in the middle of the car, or up over the rear axle. They hit that at the equivalent highway speed of 50 miles an hour. And they have a crash test site, and they run into it. Either they drag the car backwards into a fixed barrier, or they run a truck with a big plywood front and hit it this way. And then they film it, and they see what the damage is, and they see if the fuel system maintains integrity. In fact, one of the funny moments in the trial is when the Ford puts a guy there who explains how they do crash testing. And they don't put gasoline in the fuel system. They put Stoddard solvent, which is a dye. And we asked him why he did that. And of course the answer is with a dye, you can see later exactly where it went and how it gets out. So it has some useful purposes. To Ford's astonishment, his first answer was, well, you don't want to put gas in that. We got expensive camera equipment in that area. You know, that blows up. We're gonna have a problem here. You know, we looked over at the Ford table and you just see the lawyer. He got 50, no leakage. 1616 was the prototype Pinto. This is not a mass-produced car, but they've built it up. They've cobbled it, as they say. They hit that at 17 and lost fuel system integrity. That's pretty low speed. That's pretty low speed. Three things happened at 17. Fuel left the fuel system, number one. Number two, the floor pan welds failed. So now you got gas out of the fuel system, and now you have a way for the fuel to get into the car. And number three, both doors jammed. That's what the experts call classic pinhole failure. You got gas in the car, and you can't get out. Not good. In our crash, the passenger door jammed, the other one flung open, and then came back and pinned her leg and partially jammed at that point.
Yeah, the tailpipe, was that above the gas tank?
To the side.
No, but was it higher than the gas tank?
Roughly the same level.
The reason I'm asking is that a friend had a Pinto, and when they drove around, their kids would be in the back seat, and they were always complaining about how hot their feet were.
Yeah.
Because of that tailpipe.
Yeah. The interesting thing about there's a couple of interesting things about the design. We can talk a little bit about what all the theories were, but the main thing to remember about the design is the pinhole had what was called a 20-inch rear overhang. That is, from the middle of the rear axle to the back of the structure of the car was 20 inches. It was the smallest rear overhang in the history of automobiles, other than the Volkswagen Beetle. Okay? Certainly the smallest in an American car. Now, you got to fit a gas tank in there. So basically you get about an inch and a half from the back of the bumper before the gas tank starts. At the front end, you got 3/4 of an inch between the front end of the gas tank and the business end of the bolts holding the differential housing on. Which means that it doesn't take much before you've engaged the gas tank on both sides. Puncture wounds here, puncture wounds there, and then if you squeeze it, and even if you don't puncture it, then you get hydrostatic crush, and then it just blows up. Plus, the other thing that's interesting is the way the filler pipe was assembled. Nobody does this anymore, but in those days, here's the opening to the tank, and here's the filler pipe that goes out to the fender. It fits in here. It's not fastened there. It just fits in here and floats. It's fastened at the fender. Think just a moment about what happens when you crush the car, the fenders go out, you got no filler pipe. What we call filler pipe pullout. It's a classic thing. Well, now what they have is it breaks away at the fender and it's fastened at the tank and it stays with the tank. So that was our basic theory. Our basic theory is that the gas tank's in the wrong place. If you just put it up in front of the rear axle. By the way, it wasn't. It's not as if it's an easy engineering feat. And it was pretty clear to do it, you're going to have a car that was maybe a little more than 42 inches high. But, you know, that was one of the constraints Lee had put on it. Yeah. Yes, sir.
You never quite explained the actual verdict. What was the actual verdict on the case?
Yeah. Let me explain that. Two stages. On the motion to dismiss, the court found that we could bring the lawsuit, that Ford was exposed to the criminal penalties of the state of Indiana. So all the purely legal issues we won on. In fact, the professors love to tell the trial lawyers later, we won our half. You know, we won the theory stuff. What happened to your trial lawyer? We tried it for 10 weeks. The case was moved out of Elkhart County, which is a kind of metropolitan county in Indiana. It was moved to a very, very rural county. We got a jury which was unusually old, unusually male, five of whom owned Ford trucks, in a very small town, and we got a judge who was afraid of the case. It had so much media stuff, it was so new, the judge basically wouldn't let us put much evidence in. He was just so terrified about this case. Ford hired his former partner as their local counsel, so there's a lot of that. The jury was out for 5 days. We were astounded. I mean, by the time we got done trying the case, we knew we couldn't win it because we couldn't get the evidence in. They still stayed out 5 days. Then they came back with a not guilty When I would go around the country talking about this case, and Terry does too, after about 6 years passed, everywhere we would go, people would say, oh yeah, that's when you won that case against Ford. We lost the case. The net effect, publicly, is we won the case. Sound a little bit like O.J.? Did O.J. win that case? You know, what do you mean by win, right? And what we think happened as a result of that is, for one thing, safety now does sell. People are much more conscious about it, and the companies feel that they have to do a lot of their marketing is about safety now, because people have had their consciousness raised about safety and they care about things like that. One of my favorite examples was in 1980, the brochure for the 1980 Pinot. That was the last year. It ran from 71 to 80. There's one section in the brochure there that Ford puts out as a promo piece, with all the parts of the car shown, and you know, little arrows. There's no gas tank. Not at all. At that point, you know, they didn't want to. They couldn't mislead you and show you it was somewhere else because it wasn't. But they didn't want to call your attention to it. So this was a car without without a gas tank. Yeah.
Why?
I'm sorry, Bill.
Well, you partly answered my question, and there was such a lack of any concern of safety. I mean, they had proven airbags worked back in the 60s. And I know that you won the Pinto case partly on the merits, but it was also partly on a social change, and you talked about the sociology of law, which fascinates me. What else sort of impacted your success, because it was a successful case?
Yeah.
And why did we move to sort of a corporate liability, you know, other than this individual thing? Mm-hmm. Because now it's both everywhere, and in some cases it's nowhere.
Right.
I mean, there still is no corporate liability in some ways, because now it's international. So the federal regs don't. So where are we now with that?
There have actually been a number of convictions since our case in other states brought against corporations on some products, and more in cases where workers are hurt. But the whole notion that corporations can't be criminally responsible, that's just a thing of the past. Nobody raises that anymore. It's just clear they can be criminally responsible. That's such a big question. There's so much to that. The culture has changed. I think what we're seeing now is a bit of the pendulum coming back the other way. Everything we're seeing, at least in the tort reform area, is the kind. It's the same kind of cry you see here in 71. Competitiveness. We're losing out. The thing's going around. Iacocca makes the point that. You know, Nixon says something like, "Well, how come the Japanese make these cars safer? They're in compliance with regulations that aren't even effective yet. How are they doing that?" And he says, "They're paying their workers $1.50 an hour. We're over $7 now. This was in 1971. We can't compete." So it was all the competitiveness thing is back too. Yes.
Well, I was just wondering, the corporation thing is. I mean, isn't there a bottom line of the chairman of the corporation being liable? I mean, that's what I don't understand. I mean, especially like Lee Iacocca or Henry Ford, you know, I mean, isn't there somebody that's liable? They're in charge of all those decisions. And I don't know. I guess I just feel like I'm a school teacher, and, you know, our principal says, you know, whatever we do, you know, he takes the brunt of it.
Right.
And that he will stand up for us,
right?
And then there, and then on us, you know. And he's the kind that would,
right?
But not all would. But,
if you mean personally liable, the whole purpose of a corporation, the whole purpose of creating the artificial structure, is to say, when the corporate assets run out, you can't go after the personal estate of the people who own and run it. So limited liability was the whole purpose for it. On the criminal side, though, we could have prosecuted some of the individuals criminally as well as human beings. We had a couple of problems. First of all, we didn't know ahead of time who they were. How do you know? You don't know how the corporation works. And secondly, we didn't want to put people in jail in Indiana for something they had done in Michigan. That was not the purpose of the case. The purpose of the case really was aimed not at people, but at the corporation as such, to kind of make them in generally more socially responsible. Yeah.
When you try to get, I mean, the purpose of the case really is to get a manufacturer not to make an unsafe car. Mm-hmm. And so you look forward 10 or 12 years and Suzuki gets exposed in Consumer Reports mm-hmm. for making a car that rolls over. Do they learn? Or what's, I mean, what's the trend and how do you bring that forward 10 or 12 years and say, hey,
well, yeah,
is there a gradual steepening of the curve here where the manufacturer, you know, has some damage or?
Well, I think so. I think there's a lot of studies that show that vehicles are safer than they were. Whether they're as safe as they could be, who knows? About all you can do is, I think the corporations are, after all, commercial creatures. They're going to run a cost. Well, they're going to run a cost-benefit analysis. What you can do is you can drive that cost up. You can tell them that, you know, when this vehicle is unsafe, we're going to really hit you for more damages. So the next thing you know, instead of saying 180 burn deaths times 200,000, they might have to say 180 burn deaths times $2 million because that's the way juries are now coming out with verdicts in these cases. So you can change the equation a little bit that they deal with. Plus, I think, you know, in a lot of these companies, once they're faced with it, you know, they have a lot of nice people in those companies. And once you kind of get this information to them, you know, they say, well, we don't want to make a product that hurts a lot of people. You know, the profit motive only goes so far, and then people say, you know, that's not the idea here.
Well, the problems you have is in a big corporation, if it starts at this level, working its way up, you can filter the data. It gets filtered all the way up, so no matter how many levels you go up, it's going to come up to the top level, and eventually you have a report that you can really depend on.
That's right. That's
right. I work for a nameless large corporation who makes airplanes. It's been interesting seeing the decision process. Sometimes it's, I wouldn't call it a filtering so much as
they don't want to tell batteries.
Pardon?
They don't want to say anything.
No. They use a different yardstick. I don't know. I would call it endemic to the measures of merit used at this decision level are different than down here. We might have a design decision further on that costs us a little bit more, and they'll look at, well, all they considered, we'll go with the cheaper decision because we don't feel the weight impact or
I can say this, when I go and ask my people, sometimes they have to draw it out of them. They don't have to tell me the bad news.
Right. Now, I have seen cases where a design change is vested and the people who started it really don't want to be convinced they should have decided something different. That's easy to see. That filtering I agree with. But,
yeah.
Two
different things have happened. And to just try this question again, I think in part, some of the products have been made safer. People have been sensitized. Another thing happened. That is, the way records are kept in the company is more secretive now. They know that lawyers can get this information, and so now they don't create the information. One of my favorite documents is an early one. Before they knew lawyers were going to come and get it, and they were just kind of being honest because they were talking to each other about what happened. They ran a 5-mile-an-hour rear end hit to check for bumpers because there was a bumper standard. And the bumper had to have a certain amount of tolerance to a 5-mile-an-hour hit. Well, the crash testers in those days who didn't care about it just made notes of everything because they thought it was information. They lost the fuel system. They had fuel leakage at 5 miles an hour. Now, it's probably a kind of a freak that it happened. You usually wouldn't. But they marked it right on the crash test. Oh, we went bonkers when we saw this. That they know they can at least lose it. Now, after that, and they used to say things on the reports. Stoddard solvent poured from the opening, gushed from the opening. After that, they would always say Stoddard solvent leakage in excess of 1 ounce per minute, because that was the government standard. That was the official standard. You couldn't lose more than an ounce per minute. So it was in excess. It's like standing below the waterfall saying it's coming down in an excess of 1 ounce per minute. Right? Yeah. Jim?
That bumper standard, just a comparison, tomatoes that are mechanically harvested have to be able to withstand a 5-mile-an-hour impact, too. So I always thought that you should just take your car and line it with tomatoes. And you have the same thing.
Be safer than the bumpers,
right?
Yeah. Do they really?
Yeah, because otherwise it damages the fruit. So that's why you get tomatoes that are so hard. because they mechanically tick now.
I love it. Yeah.
Is there, you talk a little bit about the history of the corporation as individual here. Is there a substantially different legal tradition than some of the other countries in terms of how the corporation is treated?
Yeah, well, there are some companies in which you can't have a limited liability form of operation. That is, you can't start a company and insulate your own personal wealth from the damage that you cause. It started in British law. French had limited liability companies as well. So was Continental. I think the tradition in the other countries is not nearly so strong as ours of going after corporations criminally, but instead going after, trying to find the particular individuals and prosecuting them criminally. It is tough in big companies, huh?
You can't pick out that one individual because he's getting orders from someone.
That's right.
It's difficult to isolate. He's there, smoking gun letter.
Well, also, there's some cases, at least in with nameless airplane manufacturers, more of a...
It's an attitude.
That's right.
Well, there's also more of a cultural push, supposedly, to make team decisions as opposed to a management decision. So, again,
I know a corporate culture in the Midwest where they absolutely want to hear everything they possibly can in their work. It's a fairly small company, and they're aiming for 99% efficiency, and anytime anybody wants to shut down the line, they can do it. It's absolutely clear in that corporate culture, and I think other ones try to diffuse responsibility in such a way that nobody's
paying on their productive output. Not necessarily if they shut down the line, they're not paid. So there are financial incentives that you have to be careful of, too. When you say, yeah, we had this great shutdown procedure, anybody in this line can shut down, everybody on that line is still paid by the output per hour or per minute or whatever it is. You shut it down, but it's still affecting what goes right here in my back pocket.
We talked about this a little bit yesterday, but there's not only different corporate cultures, there's different corporate philosophies.
Right.
General Motors, who had the same problem, settled all the cases that were brought and settled it almost immediately for pretty big dollars. Ford's philosophy was to settle nothing, admit nothing. In fact, many cases in which they just, federal courts have found that they just lied on depositions. They said documents didn't exist and they started showing up in other lawsuits. So that's what Ford finally brought in a big law firm from New York City to manage their litigation nationwide, because it was embarrassing when a document was being shown to a jury in Los Angeles at the same time a Ford executive in Nashville was saying it didn't exist. And so they finally coordinated all that. But their philosophy about this was just different from the beginning. Sometimes you win with that philosophy and sometimes you lose big time.
What kind of punishment would you have assessed, or if you had one criminally, what were you thinking would be fair in terms of a...
We never really got to the question of thinking about that because the statute was very clear that it was a maximum of $10,000 per debt.
Okay.
We never viewed it as something where anybody would get money or anybody would go to jail. We talked to one of the lawyers later. Indiana did not permit what was called a plea of nolo contendere. You all remember what nolo contendere is? It's been successfully used by vice presidents of the United States mainly, right? Which is no contest, which is we're not admitting anything, but we can't see the point of going through the lawsuit. And one of the Ford lawyers told us, if you had had that plea, we would have just entered it. Because every day the trial went on, the publicity was killing us. It didn't really matter after a point whether we won or lost. One interesting sidelight is, just like the OJ case, there was two trials. There was the one in the courtroom and then there was the one in the newspaper. 4 days running, right before the trial started, front page in the Chicago Tribune, with all of these Ford documents.
Oh,
Ford knew it was going to kill 180 and decided to do so. It didn't put in a $5.65 part. Could have cured all this. They knew it. Interesting. Interesting how the Chicago Tribune got that information, because we couldn't give it to them.
Hmm.
You know, that's not right.
right? All kind of ethics about that. Chicago Tribune legal affairs editor came and said, I want those documents. We said, we can't give them to you. We have an ethical problem. He said, well, aren't they filed in court? I said, yes, we filed them in court. We attached them to a motion for discovery. He says, so the judge has them? Yeah, small town, Winnemac, Indiana. Remember the population? I don't know, 1,200. Tiny town. We basically took the town over. He goes up to the judge, noon, and he says, can I see the prosecution's motion for discovery? And that's the one we had appended all the documents to. Judge says, yeah, I'm going out to lunch. Sure, here it is. And if you need to photocopy anything, it's right down there. Didn't ask him who he was, anything. That hit the front page of the Tribune, and Ward's lawyers went nuts. They came to over to our cabin screaming and yelling.
Couldn't they file for, well, if they had lost, they could file for a mistrial in that case, couldn't they?
Sure, probably.
A couple questions on procedure. In a civil case, all you have to do is get a majority of the jurors to rule one way or the other, right?
Depends. Some states, yes. Some states require unanimity there, too. But more often, it's less than unanimous. We needed a unanimous jury, 12 persons.
So it had to be 12 persons. And then, did you do a lot of your research based on the 14th Amendment, which was sort of reinterpreted by the Supreme Court after the Sherman Antitrust, which made a corporation a person? The corporations themselves sought that protection?
Not an issue. They did not do that.
That was already established.
No. That was established, right? That was not a problem for us. And I've kept you a long time already.
So the family out of this.
Please feel free to go if you want early lunch, whatever. I'll sit around with whoever wants to talk.
You don't have a dish team today.
Huh?
No dish team today.
No.